within the past few weeks, an 800-page book had been published by one of the really great Anglican, appropriately, New Testament scholars, who's going to be made Bishop of Durham, I think, soon. His name is Nicholas Wright. His friends call him Tom, apparently. On the resurrection. There's not a great deal written on the resurrection, as a matter of fact, but Wright, according to the review that I read, has this very systematic discussion of belief in the resurrection among the Jews, because it's a Jewish belief as opposed to the way that the Greeks and Romans believed, which was that you had a soul which couldn't die because it didn't have any moving parts. The Jews didn't believe that at all, and that's why they always talked about a bodily resurrection, because for the Jews, who didn't know about souls, the only kind of person there was had to be a body person. It's unthinkable to be a human being and not to have a body, which is why we have the resurrection of the body as a central belief. But having said all that, that doesn't solve all the problem by a long, long stretch. And I'm going to read Wright's book to see what else he does, because apparently he insists, according to the reviewer, on this notion of the physicality of the resurrection. Meanwhile, on the internet, of course, Bishop Spong, the late archbishop, he's still alive, but he used to be Bishop of Newark, New Jersey, now has a lecture series on the internet that you can get every day, and he talks about the resurrection in quite different terms, pointing out that in the resurrection narratives of all four Gospels, it's virtually impossible to coordinate them. Jesus is up north, Jesus is down south, Jesus appears here, Jesus appears here. Well, how are you going to put all that stuff together? And it's impossible to do. And Spong makes the issue that raises the question that we need to look more closely at this business of the physicality of the resurrection. The reason I'm going through all that is that this passage from Luke raises the stakes. I mean, you get Jesus eating a fish sandwich. I mean, you can't get more physical than that, the risen Jesus. And that's supposed to be an accreditation of the fact that this is the risen Jesus. Well, a bunch of things need to be said. I think, first of all, Luke is famous among the four canonical evangelists for, as one writer puts it, materializing religious realities, giving them concrete, physical, material form as a way of expressing these religious realities. When Jesus is baptized in the Gospel of Luke, only Luke has a real pigeon sitting on Jesus' head. Everybody else has something like a dove or a voice or something. But no, Luke physicalizes, specifies this. And I understand the impulse, but there is a danger in doing it. There's a danger in doing anything, of course. There's a danger in doing nothing, too. But the danger I want to try to talk about today is that of reducing the resurrection to simply believe that God is going to resuscitate this corpse. And that's it. That's the meaning of the resurrection. Now, Luke does not want to say that, but it's very easy to take this text or the text from John that we read last Sunday about Jesus showing up to the so-called doubting Thomas and people putting their digits in holes in Jesus' hand and all that other business. First of all, it addresses, especially in the wake of this guy's funeral, it addresses one of the great human questions. Is death the end of everything? None of us wants to say that. None of us wants to believe that. And so on one level, there's a profound human desire that the terror of death is somehow modified or even dissolved by the fact that I'm still going to be around somehow. But that is not what the resurrection is about, however important that may be at some level. Because the Jews for centuries didn't believe in the resurrection. They just figured when you're dead, you're dead. Because if you were a body person and the body stops breathing, then you just are finished. You have no existence after death. So what is all this about? What does the resurrection have to do with? Well, we can get to a particularly Lucan approach to it when he has the risen Jesus over and over. If you remember the way of the disciples on the way to Emmaus, you remember every resurrection depiction in the Gospel of Luke has Luke explaining that there was kind of inevitability about Jesus' death and resurrection. It had to happen. It's the fulfillment of all the promises. I mean, these last lines. Then he opened their minds to understand the scripture, and he said to them that it is written that the Christ would suffer. Well, folks, that's Luke, the theologian, at work. That's Luke trying to make sense of this horror and shock and scandal that was the crucifixion of Jesus. And he said, but if it had to happen, then it's okay, it's okay. And Luke wants to say, though, at a deeper level, that the resurrection of Jesus is the fulfillment of everything that the God of the Jews had in mind for human beings. Which is what? That the Jews were to be God's agents in the whole of the human scene to prove to them that God is a God of everybody. That all of our normal ways of describing, defining ourselves, which is basically tribal, I think, is unfaithful to God. And so if God raised this man who was, in fact, available to everybody, then that is precisely the fulfillment of God's promise all the way back to Abraham. The whole of Jewish history. And that's really important, enormously important. But I'd like to suggest that even that doesn't get to what can be, I think, legitimately seen as yet a deeper level of meaning of the resurrection. Because to say that God is the God of everybody is still fairly safe and abstract, you know, most of the time. Most of us can live with that in some kind of remote corner of our brain and then carry on our lives, you know, with that quiet assurance that that's the way it's supposed to happen. The larger, I think, meaning of the resurrection is that this man who was, in fact, came to be, grew up to be, as the Gospel of Luke itself says, grew in wisdom and age and grace. The man that his very openness to everybody was itself the very definition of what it was to be a human being. And I think this is a much more immediate, closer to the bone thing than God is the God of everybody or the fulfillment of the scriptures or all this other business. To believe that God has raised this Jew, this Jewish man, is to say that not that death is not final or that good will triumph over evil, because that's still too abstract. No, you have in the most concrete and detailed and specific ways this human life of this man who said no to nobody. Said yes to everybody that he ran into, and above all, the people that everybody else ignored. Now that, I think, is just about at the very heart of the matter. I want to try to figure out what it is to be a human being, then if I believe that God has raised this man from the dead, that means that that is the very definition of what it is to be a human being. To break down all the filtration systems, the tribalizing impulses in me. Or to put it at its most radical, to say that the law of preservation is somehow abrogated. The law of self-preservation is abrogated. Because that's the basis of greed, of tribalism, of desire to have some post-mortal existence. I think self-preservation. I want to be around after I'm dead even. Well, what Jesus says is that won't wash as the fundamental human impulse. To want to preserve myself, and we do this in gazillions of ways every day. I do. And so far as I can tell, the rest of us do the same thing. To desire to preserve myself in any number of ways, in all number of ways, is the fundamental impulse of my life. So I make decisions as to whom to exclude, whom to include, whom to value, whom to disvalue, whom to pay attention to, whom to ignore, that all these are functions of this desire for self-preservation. And as a footnote, I mean, you can use this as a criterion for judging the quality of the churches as well. Because you look at the churches, my God, if we have a scandal, it is precisely to analyze how profound and pervasive is the impulse of self-preservation of these institutional forms of religion. If you don't believe it, all you have to do is look at the newspaper. So, the law of self-preservation is abrogated in Jesus. Why? Because Jesus apparently was much concerned about his connection with God, so that the question of preserving his own life simply disappeared. Was not significant. Therefore, he could move through his existence with a freedom and a courage that is dazzling. Okay. Just to attach this to this wilderness business. Wilderness has, as I hope, I say to myself and to you, has multiple meanings. I mean, the world is a jungle. It's a rat race, you know. You got to look out for number one. That's, I put it to you, a reasonable description of the wilderness, of the wild. The jungle is the wild, you know. So that's one understanding of wilderness. And so we can say, yeah, we live in the wilderness. Because if I don't look out for number one, who's going to, by God? And so everybody is a real or potential competitor for a finite list of goods, of reputation, of degrees, of money, of sex, of power, of whatever. What the resurrection means is the substitution, the replacement of that kind of wilderness for an even more terrifying kind of wilderness. Which is this, to live in the first kind of wilderness, but with one's head totally transformed, that the real wilderness is this God, this mysterious other, who does hold me in her hands in a way that I cannot secure, guarantee, because to do that is to precisely circumvent the freedom of God. That's wilderness. That's the Christian wilderness. Lead kindly life amid the encircling gloom. The night is dark, and I am far from home. What was Newman talking about? The darkness of the world, which is the first wilderness. Guide thou my steps. I do not wish to see the distant scene, because that gives me all kinds of security, safety. I know where I am, I know where I'm going, and I therefore don't have to pretend that I'm connected to you. Lead thou me on. Lead thou me on. That's wilderness. That's real wilderness. That's the wilderness the resurrection speaks to. And it's appropriate, I suppose, that we talk about that poem of John Henry Newman, the great Anglican divine who joined the Roman Church and didn't want papal infallibility defined at the First Vatican Council. Quite an interesting set of connections with John Henry Newman. But that's what the resurrection wilderness